Good morning and welcome to the Wayne Eddy Affair on your radio station, KYMN 1080 on your AM dial, and of course, 95.1 FM, The One. Well, we have an interesting show again today on KYMN, and it's kind of an overcast day, and today is Tuesday, the 21st day of August, and the year is 2018. I have an interesting guest. I know Jeff and Terry have been talking about John Beeland being in studio at 9 o'clock. I had a moment to say, hello, how are you? Nice weather we're having. But I don't know him, so as we get to know him, I get to know him. Good morning, John. Thank you very much for stopping by.
Good morning, Wayne. How are you doing?
I'm doing terrific. Yeah. I'm looking forward to our interview. Have you ever done a sit-down two-hour radio interview?
I've done some long ones in the past, but it's great to do it with somebody like yourself that's professional and has been around for a long time, like me.
Boy, so, I'll tell you, I gain a lot of respect the older I get, just because of the age.
No kidding, huh? You know, well, Keith Richards is still walking around, so he's our barometer, I guess.
I like to call it vertical. I want to get to know you a little bit.
Yeah.
I understand you're a professional, and I asked if you would please bring a CD, and I see you have brought one, and we'll play some of that music so that people get to know who you are.
Okay.
But why are you in Northfield?
Well, I'm here to do a show for the service, the people who train the service dogs, and my road manager, Doug Kelder, has one that he got from up here. And Doug, they were doing a benefit, and Doug said, hey, listen, would you like to come out and do the show? And I said, absolutely, because what a great cause, you know. I mean, what these dogs do is just mind-boggling, you know. And I got a chance to go up and see the dogs and the trainers yesterday. And I'm thrilled to be here in Northfield because I'm one of my hobbies is Western history, you know, and so I grew up hearing all about Northfield and the James boys, but I've never really been here. So yesterday I went to the museum and
good
walked
for you.
Around and
good for you.
It's fantastic, you know. It's great to be here. I'm such a Western fan of the Old West that it's to actually be at the same place.
Have you ever read True West magazine?
I subscribe to it. Yeah, sure.
Well, guess what? The raid here in Northfield, Minnesota has been number one Western reenactment
for
12 years in a row.
Oh, I never knew that.
Yeah.
And, wow. I just read an article about the raid in True West last night, as a matter of fact. Bob Osbell, I think, wrote it.
We're getting close to it. We're going to be celebrating that.
That's right.
And doing the reenactment the weekend after Labor Day.
Wow.
And
wow.
You ever had an opportunity after a performance where you just your adrenaline is just so high
because
going on and then doing the show and getting done with it and you just kind of go come down? Well, that's what happens in the raid reenactments.
I bet
they have it's true to history. And we do rob the bank, and I say we because I did it for over 25 years. And adrenaline, as you're waiting for the announcer to say, and now, after he tells everybody what's going on or is going to go on, and now, and then you go in and rob the bank and get back on your horse
out. Yeah, I'd love to see that. I wish we were sticking around longer. But, I remember reading all sorts of books and stories about it, and it's just amazing to actually stand there in the bank with the original floorboards of the bank, you know, below you.
Have you ever heard of a guy named John Kennerly from London?
No, that name's really
England.
Familiar. Where do I know that from?
Well, he wrote, he made an album, a musical album.
That's right.
That had Albert Lee and Charlie Devil Goes Down to Georgia.
Charlie Daniels.
Charlie Daniels. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also Roseanne Cash.
You're exactly right. I had forgotten about him, you know, but I remember that concept album that they did back then.
And two of them are Northfield the Raid and Northfield the Aftermath. And it's done musically and in storytelling.
Oh,
Emmy Lou Harris.
I wonder if that album's still floating around, available to get.
Somewhere I have the album, hopefully, and somewhere I have a reel-to-reel of it. Yeah. And he came to town, and I took him with me to schools, because before the Friday of the first week of school, we're doing our Defeated Jesse James Day celebration.
Right.
So the rodeo people and some of the Raiders and the Miss Defeated Jesse James Days goes around to all the elementary schools.
Yeah.
And we tell the story about Joseph Lee Haywood, the hero that got killed in the raid.
That's right.
And then Kennerly came with, and I took him to the museum.
I bet he loved it.
He said it was like walking in, being an artist and walking into the St. Peter's Church or whatever.
That's how I felt yesterday, you know, after reading, you know, my whole life reading about it and actually being right there in the bank. And I was struck by how small it was. You know?
Yeah.
I thought, you know, being a bank, I thought it had been a much larger size.
And when you stood looking at the bank vault.
Whoa, there's Jesse.
You were standing on the same floor that Frank James and a couple others.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. It's you know, I've been on the road now, touring since I was 18, and I've seen a lot of incredible, you know, places. And but to actually be in the bank where Jesse James held up, I mean, it was just, for me, it was fabulous.
Well, I would like you, if you would open that, please. I want people to hear what you're doing.
Sure.
First of all, let's find out, when are you appearing and where are you appearing?
Oh, okay. Now, the exact location, I don't have it in front of me now. I guess my road manager would know it.
Doug, give us a call at 645-5695.
Yeah, Doug. I'm playing to tonight at, I think, around 7 o'clock. And I think we're sold out, so I'm really happy about that. And I'll be doing stuff from my book. I have a brand new book out, and my book is about my career playing guitar and recording and writing hits for people like everybody from Garth Brooks to Dolly Parton, Linda Ronstadt. You know, so it's kind of a summation of 50 years of being in Los Angeles and then playing on records in Nashville, Tennessee, and Ricky Nelson.
I got stories about him.
A lot of people. I was Rick's guitar player for years, played on his records, and toured.
Do you know the story of the Garden song?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, we'll have to talk about that.
Yeah.
But do you know Bob Wooten? Did you know Bob Wooten?
That name, again, rings a bell with me.
Where do 30 years with Johnny Cash on guitar.
I know him once because I did the Johnny Cash show in 1970 with Linda Ronstadt, and I remember I banged on we were staying at the Ramada Inn, and I was trying to get one of my band members, and I came to his door, and I banged on the door just joking to shake him up, and it was the wrong door, and it was Bob Wooten's door.
Okay.
He answered the door. Yeah. And you know, he was kind of an intimidating looking guy.
Oh, I was going to say, if you opened the door and said, what the,
want? Yeah, I went, I'm sorry, Mr. Wooten.
Yeah. Well, he sat right there where you are.
Oh, yeah.
And we had a 2-hour
I bet you did,
session
on
two different occasions.
Yeah.
And he passed away 2 years ago month.
Really? Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Yeah. No, I knew John and June, and I played with Christofferson for many years, and so I got to know John through Chris, and then I ended up moving just down the road from John in Hendersonville, Tennessee, and I did the Johnny Cash show in 1970 I was with Linda Ronstadt, so it was Linda Ronstadt, James Taylor, Tony Joe White, Earl Scruggs, and while we were there that week for the show, we did it at the Grand Ole Opry for the Vanderbilt students. They brought them in. And we, while we were there, we went over to this recording studio. James Taylor was recording. Neil Young was recording there, and Linda put her harmony on "Heart of Gold." You know, every time I hear it, every time I hear it in the supermarket, you know, I think of that winter night when we went to the studio, and there she was out there singing.
Or the instrumental version on an elevator.
Yeah, on an elevator. Yeah, that's right.
We're going to have to let people, can I have
the
CD? Thank you very much. And I am going to play a song. What cut would you like me to play?
Well, I'll tell you what, since I work with Linda, this is my version of the song I did with her called Different Drum, and it was written by Mike Nesmith, and this is my version. Mike Smith of the Monkees.
Yeah. What cut is it?
And it was Linda's first hit. It's called a Different Drum. And let me put my glasses on here. I'll tell everybody.
I know what you mean by it right here.
track number three.
Okay, let's get to track number three. And ladies and gentlemen, in studio guest this morning is John Beeland, and this is his version of Linda Ronstadt's Golden Heart.
Different drum.
Is that the one you and me marching?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Oh, good. Mm-hmm. Well, listen. And then we'll find out where you're appearing. Oh, yeah. Wow. I like it.
Yeah.
You and I travel to the beat of a different drum. I can't you tell by the way I run? Every time you make eyes at me, will you cry and moan and say it'll work out? Ah, but honey child, I've got my doubts. You can't tell the forest from the trees. Ah, but don't get me wrong, it's not that I knock, it is just that I am not in the market for a girl who wants to love only me. Yes, and I ain't saying you ain't pretty. All I'm saying is I'm not ready for any person, place, or thing trying to pull the reins in on me. So goodbye, I'll be leaving, I see no sense. If it's crying and grieving, we'll both live a lot longer if you live without me. It's not that I knock, it's just that I am not in the market for a girl who wants to love only me. Yes, and I ain't saying you ain't pretty. All I'm saying is I'm not ready for any person, place, or thing trying to pull the reins in on me. So goodbye, I'll be leaving, I see no sense. If it's crying and grieving, we'll both live a lot longer if you live without me.
From our studios in downtown Northfield, Minnesota, we have John Beeland in studio. He just got done singing that song, and I love the melody of that song.
It's really neat. If you heard Mike Nesmith's original version of it, you'd be surprised, because he does a really kind of bluegrassy old country, and it doesn't resemble that at all. But that was Linda's first hit, and that's when I joined her back once upon a time.
Well, one of the monkeys went to school here at Carleton.
Oh, which one? Do you know?
I don't know their name.
There's Peter, there's Davey, and Mike.
Do you know the
Mickey?
Last?
Mickey Dolan's, Peter Tork.
Tork, that's right.
Yeah,
one.
Peter Tork. Peter comes down to where I live in Texas. He's got relatives there, and you know. And
You'll have to tell him next time you see him.
I will. I'll tell him.
Hey, I was in Northfield just
Wayne 80 says to say hello.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
What about Johnny Western?
Johnny Western, I remember him playing in Vegas. Whenever I would play Vegas, he was usually in the lounges playing Johnny Yuma was a Rebel.
Yeah, and also Paladin.
Oh, yeah, Paladin, that's right. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And you imagine the little checks he gets every month? Playing all over the world.
Well, I'll tell you about those little checks.
Yeah, tell me about it.
I sang a theme song back in 1968 for a TV show. That I didn't think much about it other than the fact that it was $250 for singing on it. And for me,
in 68?
When you're 18 years old, and it's 1968 bucks, it was in single, it was a lot of dough. So anyway, I sang the theme, and I didn't think much about it until actually years later. Even when the show came out for the first year, I didn't watch it because it was kind of a cornball show. And that show was The Brady Bunch.
Oh,
and
for
I was the guy.
Sakes.
I sang the first year the title for the song, and But there was a rule back then in 1968 that you could only receive residuals for the first run. So you had the first run and the rerun. And after that, that was it. They didn't change that rule until the next year.
Oh, you missed
and
it.
And I miss it. So I get absolutely nothing from the Brady Bunch other than, somebody will come up to me and go, wow, you did the Brady Bunch. And I didn't realize how big the show was until many years later when they did the movies, the parody movies, and my daughter came in one time. I was recording in my studio, and then my daughter came in with her friends. They were about 10 years old. And she said, tell him, Dad, tell him you were the guy who sang that.
Yeah.
And, that was, I would like to get royalties from that show, I'll tell you.
Well, Johnny Western, whose real name is Johnny Westerlund, mm-hmm. and his father was AD, athletic director at the high school.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And his family was very talented, musically talented. Mm-hmm. And one of his buddies was Johnny Cash.
Right.
And so occasionally he would bring Johnny Cash home to meet Mom.
Yeah.
You know, this was before KYMN was on the air or shortly thereafter.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a connection there. I always say when I have a guest, no matter what, that there's some kind of a connection that you can make.
Well, the business is a small business. And if you've been in it on a successful level and touring and playing and stuff, you're eventually going to cross paths with just about everybody. And I've been doing this, like I said, I've been recording and touring and playing with big acts since I was 18. As a matter of fact, 17, because my parents had to sign my first publishing deal out in Hollywood. But when I guess the guy that I work with who traveled the most, that I really got to learn about radio and it was a guy named Johnny Tillotson. Do you remember Johnny? He had a record out called Poetry in Motion.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it keeps right on a hurting.
Yep. Da, da, da.
Well, Johnny, I was his musical director for years, and he took me around the world a million times, it felt like.
He reminded me of Bobby Darin.
Bobby Darin.
A little bit, you know?
That's right. The same kind of era, you know? And Johnny taught me everything. Johnny had a degree in broadcasting, as a matter of fact. He got in Florida before he even started out. But he knew everything. And it was just he and I traveling. You know, we used bands in different towns. And so we were the best of friends. And he would do a lot of towns like Northfield and places that were kind of off the beaten path for major performers. And I loved it. I got to meet Salt of the Earth people, Salt of the Earth radio people. And to me, that the roots of real music and going out there in the field and seeing these people. And so he was a great guy to learn from. And
by the way, you're appearing at the NAG Theater tonight.
Oh, good.
And there are only about a dozen tickets
left.
Can
you give me directions so I know how to...
well, I'll tell you, you could walk over there.
If you see me walking around Main Street.
And, as a matter of fact, it's a block away from the Quarterback Club, which is a great restaurant here in town.
Oh, good.
That's
good.
Locally owned and locally managed, and they're known for their great breakfasts.
Uh-huh.
And they serve breakfast till 10 o'clock every morning, except Sunday, where the nonprofits have their pancake feeds, and they want them to have as many patrons at that. But anyhow, it's locally owned, locally managed, and they have the best baby back barbecued ribs with mountains of madness just oozing all over them in the form of a barbecue sauce.
Wayne, you're killing me here.
Oh,
I'm gaining weight as we're talking.
You know? Well, you have your host bring you over there for lunch
today, or
breakfast.
Yeah, it sounds great. Sounds fantastic. Yeah.
At 9:23, our guest this morning is John Beelan. John Beelan is a performer, and he'll be performing tonight to raise some money for... Believe It. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, another name I'm going to throw at you.
Right.
Peter Wozner.
No, I don't remember that name.
He traveled with Vince Gill.
Well, Vince is a dear friend of mine. I've known Vince since Vince was in Pure Prairie League.
Peter was his keyboard man.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I don't know him, but I know Vince and Billy, his drummer, and all those guys for years, you know. And I met Vince when he came to town to Nashville, and he was doing recording sessions and trying to get a hit record, and he did one or two, you know.
Yep.
But a great guy, Vince. Vince is terrific. And he's out now with the Eagles.
Now you mentioned, or I heard Jeff Johnson mention that you played with the Eagles.
I played with Glenn Frey and John David Souther and Bernie Ledden, who were the three of the Eagles before we were the Eagles. They were playing, Glenn Frey and John David Seiler were playing in a little club in, on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood in 68. And I just happened to stop by the club, little beatnik coffee house. And they were the only, I think there were about three people in the audience, you know. And they were playing underneath this one little light. And I thought that they, I thought they were great. I thought they sounded like the Everly Brothers, you know, who are, you know, were my idols.
Yeah.
And they were two skinny guys with blue, faded blue jeans with patches all over them and these jumbo Gibson guitars. And but boy, when they sang, they were like, they just knocked me on the floor. So I introduced myself and we hit it off. And the three of us played in folk clubs up and down Southern California, you know. And eventually I went with Linda Ronstadt. And then after I left Linda to go with Arlo Guthrie, she hired the Eagles to be the our replacement band. So well, the Eagles replaced us. I should have stuck with Linda Ronstadt.
How do you, Arlo Guthrie, I'm not into his music at all. And is that, how would you explain that between, let's say, pure country music, country western music, and Arlo Guthrie folk
Arlo's
music?
Arlo's a folk singer, just like his father was. And he's a terrific guy. I've known him for most of my life. I just saw him about a year ago. And he carries on the tradition, still tours, does a lot of his father's songs, of This Land Is Your Land, and then he does his own songs, which I worked on, City of New Orleans. And,
that one.
Mm-hmm, yeah, we did that together, they just released, the best gig I did with Arlo was, I did the Hollywood Bowl in 1970 with a tribute to Woody Guthrie concert, and they for the concert they selected kind of like an all-star band to back up Joan Baez, Pete Seeger, all of the greats of folk music, Odetta, Richie Havens, and we backed them up. And that album, the recording from that album, this year was put into the Library of Congress.
Wow.
So I'm extremely proud of that, even though I was only 20 years old and I can't remember most of it.
Yeah. Are you a single act?
I started out as a single. Yeah, I am pretty much. Yeah, I guess so. A songwriter, singer, producer.
We're having a conversation this morning with John Beeland, and I want to give an opportunity to, when I say John Beeland, should I say writer, producer, arranger, vocalist, guitar player?
Session musician, played on a lot of records.
Well, we're going to take a brief break. And then when I say brief, it'll be about 30 seconds.
Okay, good.
And then we'll come back and continue our conversation with Mr. Beeland.
You buy something because you got it for a low price. And soon you realize it's no bargain because you really needed something better. It happens all the time, especially with car insurance. But the good news is you can get the right coverage at the right price. Just talk to me, State Farm agent Mark Quinnell. I'll help you get the right coverage at a price that's right for you. Call me at 645-4545 today.
Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Providing insurance and financial services.
Oh, number two song in all of 1968.
Oh, I could hide. John Stewart songs.
Of the Bluebird,
that doesn't mean anything to me.
John Stewart was a member of the Kingston Trio.
Okay.
And he wrote this song, and they didn't. The Monkees didn't like it. Davy Jones didn't want to record it. He couldn't understand what it was about, you know, because it's kind of a surreal kind of a song. But John was great. He was the guy who sang Greenback Dollar and all those great Kingston Trio records.
Yeah.
He passed away a few years ago, but I still talk to his wife, Buffy, quite a bit. I say, John made a nice penny from this song.
Number two in all of 1968, the year my guest got out of high school.
Mm-hmm.
And did he ever return? No, he never returned, but his fate is still unknown.
Well, he may ride forever through the streets of Boston. But he's still the man who never returned.
when that came out, I loved the song.
Me too.
I had no idea what they were talking about.
Was it the NTA? The MTA?
Something like that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, the Kingston Trio were the Beatles of folk music, you know, so they were huge, next to Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Peter, Paul, and Mary. I story about that. And, of course, they're close association with Minnesota.
Right.
So do you think that their song about the dragon Puff, do you think that was associated with drug use?
Or I recorded with Peter. Peter Yeager, I work with him. And I don't care what he says, I'll go to the grave saying that, yes, of course it was. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, he says, no way it wasn't. But if you look at the lyrics, it's just... It's no way that it wasn't, but Peter was a great guy, very very intelligent man, and I played on a record of his Woody Guthrie tune called Deportee, and I got to play with him live too, and that was an honor because I was a big Peter Paul and Mary fan.
Have you ever you've traveled the mm-hmm. nation? Have you done any international traveling?
Oh yes, oh gosh, yeah, half my career was traveling to Europe, China, just about you name the country, I probably played in it.
Norway.
Norway. I'm very, I don't want to say very big in Norway, but Norway's been a second home to me. I have many, many friends. I've produced many albums, mostly around Kristiansand, Norway. And so it is like a second home to me, and I love it. I love Norway. I could move there tomorrow. It's so beautiful.
You know, the biggest export at one time from Sweden was ABBA music.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, ABBA is still huge. There's a lot of bands that do ABBA tributes. But Norway, surprisingly enough, has a big country music following, and they have big festivals out there and country acts, country solo acts and bands and... but for me, I for some reason, you know, what's really neat about Europe is that they continue to follow the careers of artists who have hit records here in America. Whereas here, you're as good as your latest hit. But in Norway and Germany and Europe, I found by touring with these big acts that the fans, they never forget. You know, they'll follow you to the grave. You know, and in Norway is a good example. Like the. When I did the international country music tour with Jerry Lee Lewis, Emmylou Harris, and Bellamy Brothers, and we toured all through Europe, you know, and sold out 6,000-7,000 seaters, and the people they show up with the albums. They know your history better than you do, you know, and it's crazy.
One of the things that I can I'm older than you by mm-hmm. quite a few years, mm-hmm. but one of the things that I enjoyed growing up was going to shows.
Yeah.
And they were at like a place, in my case, a prom ballroom in St. Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you just mentioned Jerry Lee Lewis.
Yeah.
And we would go to the dance mm-hmm. at the prom ballroom featuring Jerry Lee Lewis.
Sure.
Who was on stage, which was, you know, maybe 5 feet, 4 feet off the ground.
Yeah.
And the girls would sit around, and I actually stood next to the stage just to watch his act.
Yeah.
But, I mean, nowadays concerts are, you know, in huge auditoriums and stadiums and big parks, and you can't get close to them. But back in those days,
you could.
You could talk to them on stage.
It was all relatively pretty new, wasn't it? I mean, rock and roll really didn't hit its stride till probably like 55, maybe 54, 55, and the venues that they played were geared for the audience, kids, and so it was high school hops. It was a big part of my career was playing for a lot of rock and rollers, you know, like, you know, Ricky Nelson and Billy Joe Royal and people like that. And
what songs did Billy Joe Royal?
Down in the Boondocks.
Down in the Boondocks.
But they would all, you know, it was fascinating working with these people because they would tell me all these great rock and roll stories about what it was like back then in the beginning, you know, early beginning of rock and roll. And you didn't have really concerts that much. It was all, like you said, it was all sock hops. And tickets were usually like about $2 to get in to see them, you know. And but they were some of those guys were incredible. They're still hoofing it. People like Chubby Checker and them, they're still out there doing it.
So you were born about 1950?
49.
I was 41.
Yeah.
So I'm a couple of years ahead of you.
Yeah,
and
sure.
You talked about rock and roll.
Right.
I remember hearing Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel
for the
first time when I was in the eighth grade.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. Elvis was like, he was about a year or two above my likes. You know, I remember my aunt really liked Elvis, and she was about 3 years older than I was, 4 years. I was struck and knocked out by Don and Phil, the Everly Brothers, you know, whom I later got to work with. But at the time, I loved harmony, you know, and harmony acts, and I loved guitars. I loved. I don't care who the act was, if they had a guitar, I was glued to the TV. Everybody from watching Les Paul and Mary Ford to even guys like George Gobel. You know, if he came out with a guitar, I'd watch it.
Yeah,
you know?
he was here, George Gobel.
Oh, yeah. We worked with him in Vegas with Mac Davis. Yeah,
and, he joined us for the Defeated Jesse James Day's big celebration.
Really? Oh,
yeah.
Wow. Yeah, he's a funny man. Yeah. You know? But I loved guitars and I loved harmony. When the Everlys came out, I was hooked. And
now, I have to interrupt you on that one. Okay, harmonies came out. You're a single act, okay, but you like harmony.
Oh, of course.
So your bandmates harmonize with you then?
Oh, sure, absolutely.
But they're not traveling bandmates? You pick them up at the markets?
One of the groups that I was in was known for their harmonies, and it was Spanky and our gang, and they had harmonies that were like the Four Freshmen, you know. I mean, that really intricate harmonies. But being a studio singer and a studio guitar player, I had to learn harmonies. And it's kind of like there's a mathematical part of harmony that you have to know to be able to really master it. And so that was a big deal with me. I also sang on a lot of hit records as well as playing guitar on records. And so you had to be up on your toes. And part of that was listening to people like, the Four Freshmen, the Beach Boys, people like the Everly Brothers, you know.
So I have to ask you something. Mm-hmm. I'm not a Facebook guy or you know, a smartphone. And I like to use it because I can talk on it. But anyhow, I got a hello or a wave, whatever you call it, from an old girlfriend of over 50 years ago.
Uh-oh.
And I had a big crush on her back then.
Mm-hmm.
And she just was, are you the Wayne Eddy I knew and blah? And okay. Well, anyhow, it brought back memories. And the reason it brings back memories is that when we were dating, and this is like high school or just after high school, we both liked to sing. Mm-hmm. And we would harmonize with the Everly Brothers, Kathy's Clown.
Yeah, that's a song that Don wrote. I think that's what music does to you. You know, if it's a song that you has a great melody and hits you, you automatically sing along in the car. I did the same thing. Even to this day, I do that. I'll hear a Beatle tune and I'll sing the second part harmony to it while I'm driving. You know, and so I still do it.
What was the first time you turned your radio on and you could hear yourself either as a lead singer or as a backup singer in a group?
I did a session once for when I was out in Hollywood. I was 18, and I was working for a publishing company, a music publishing company, and I would play on their demos for the writers. You know, writers, when they would finish a tune, they would do a demo recording, and then that demo recording would be pitched to the major artists to see if they would record the tune. So I was hired to play the music for it, and since I was multi-instrumental, I would play the drums and the bass and all that. Well, anyway, one year they hooked me up with a writer named his name was Sonny Childs, and so the guy at the publishing company, David Nelson, he said, John, go to Sonny's house and he'll teach you the tunes and then we'll call a session and blah, blah, blah. So I went to Sonny's house, knocked on the door, and he answered. And he looked really familiar, you know. I went, wow, this guy is, who does he look like? And he's very friendly and he invited me in. And on the walls of the house, he had pictures of Sam Cooke all over the house. I mean, and I kept thinking, well, this guy really like Sam Cooke. And I said, that's who he looks like. He even looks like Sam Cooke. So I said, "What are you Sam Cooke's brother or something like that?" He said, no, I'm his nephew. And I said, wow, really cool. And so we sat down and worked out the tunes. He played them for me, three tunes. And he sounded like Sam Cooke, you know. This is incredible. So we went into the studio. We recorded the three tunes. And two of them were kind of so-so, but the third one I thought was really good, you know. And we did the record, and about a year later I was in Chicago on tour, and I was in a restaurant, and they were playing, the WLS was on.
WLS in Chicago.
That's it. And over the speakers came the tune that I had played, and it was the disc jockey said. And here's a brand new record by R.B. Graves called Take a Letter, Maria. And it was the biggest record of the year that year.
Take a Letter, Maria. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. That, so that was the first hit record I played.
And were you singing and instrumental?
No, no. He sang it, and I did the guitars, and
That ought to be pretty exciting.
It was thrilling. Are you kidding? To hear myself on the radio? Yeah. I mean, that's what you dream about when you're in bed and you have the crazy notion that you want to be a rock and roll star. I grew up in Illinois. I grew up in Hometown, Illinois, which is south of Chicago.
Is that the name of it?
Hometown, Illinois, southwest of Chicago, 95th and Cicero.
Cicero.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy.
And I grew up listening to Dick Biondi and WLS Radio, and I wanted to be a guitar player that played on records. That was my I didn't want to be a pop star. I wanted to be the guy who made the records. And as luck would have it, when I was 16, 17, my dad got a job offer in California, and six kids and my mom and dad took the Super Chief train out to Los Angeles, and about 6 months after getting there, I left home and went to Hollywood and stayed on the streets for probably about 2 to 3 weeks. And I would hang out at the recording studios and watch the acts. And that's how I got into the business, you know.
What year would that have been?
67.
67.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's
mm-hmm.
During the hippie years.
Oh, yeah. It was an incredible time. I got to tell you, I felt like, Forrest Gump. You know, I landed one minute I was in Hometown listening to Biondi on the radio, who later became a real good friend of mine, by the way, listening to Biondi. And then the next minute I'm in L.A. You know, the weirdest thing I always think about this, but when I was a kid in Chicago and about 12 or 13, I couldn't wait for Ozzy and Harriet to come on ABC TV. And then Ricky would sing a song at the end of the show. And I used to think while watching it, I said, wouldn't it be great to be playing guitar with Ricky and be his guitar player like James Burton on TV? And, you know, but there I was at Hometown, you know, fat chance. And then in 1979, I did Saturday Night Live, and I was Ricky's guitar player on Saturday Night Live. And we did Hello, Mary Lou and all those songs. Yeah. And I was the guy playing behind him on
The
same network, too, as Ozzy and Harriet. So
wow.
Life is funny. Yeah.
And who were the actors on?
Well, there was Ozzy and Harriet.
I mean, on Saturday Night Live.
Oh, there was the last season of the original cast.
So John Belushi?
Belushi.
Bill Murray?
Bill Murray, Danny Aykroyd. And we hung out a week with him because Ricky was the host that week. And so we did five tunes, and then Ricky did all these great skits, and Judy Collins was also on the show. But to be on that stage and the cameras are right below me, you can't see it on TV, but when every time there's a guitar solo, the cameras shift over to me, and it was everything I could do to keep my focus, because it was almost like a Rod Sterling episode of The Twilight Zone, you know. And because, you look up and there's Ricky, there's the cameras, I'm on ABC, and I'm doing exactly what I wanted to do when I was 12 years old in Hometown, Illinois. And at times it's still for me to kind of mind-boggling. Ricky and I went on to become the best of friends. I loved him dearly.
I want to save that story after a break, okay?
I'll tell you that.
But
sure.
I have to know, did you know Rosanna Dana?
Yeah, I did. I'll tell you what, she was a dear. Everybody on the show was just fabulous. And it was an experience to see those guys. They were, they were crazy. I'll tell you that right now. That whole outfit, the writers and everybody, were nuts. I couldn't understand how they were able to get together and actually put on a network show every week, because they were literally nuts. But boy, when the show came, they were there like troopers, and bang, bang, bang. They were the greatest. You know, it was an experience I'll never forget.
It is already 18 minutes before 10 o'clock on the Wayne Eddy Affair. My guest this morning is John Beeland. He will be performing tonight at the Northfield Arts Guild, and they have about a dozen tickets left. You'll want to go see his act, and we'll be playing his act. It's all music and a conversation about his great career, and we will be back in just a moment on KYMN, a friend you can count on.
Your vehicle's engine warning light could mean something as simple as a loose gas cap or something serious and potentially expensive if you don't address it right away. Have our professional technicians at Witt Brothers Service diagnose and fix the problem as part of your overall preventative maintenance program. It could save you from costly problems down the road. Stop by Witt Brothers Service at 701 Division Street in downtown Northfield for all of your automotive maintenance and repair needs. Residential or commercial, Cannon Valley Water in Dundas is the place to call for water. Whether it's a complete water conditioning system or just salt delivery and filters, Cannon Valley Water can take care of it. And Cannon Valley Water can also deliver Candy Yohai premium water right to your house or business at great rates, too. Chippewa Springs is as pure today as it was when we first tested it over a century ago, and is proudly distributed by Cannon Valley Water. Pickups are now located at 609 Stafford Lane in Dundas, just behind Aldi. Call Cannon Valley for your water today.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms, because I want someone to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
I like that song. I think I was a junior in high school when that was popular.
That was Rick's last hit, and I arranged that for Rick.
You did?
Yeah, and it was a Bobby Darin tune, which was one of my favorite old rockers.
Yeah, Bobby Darin mm-hmm. would be the one that I
yeah,
heard.
Yeah, he wrote it. And
wow.
Yeah, and it was always one of my favorite tunes, and so I had an arrangement of it. Ricky and I were doing an album called The Memphis Sessions, and we were coming up with tunes, and I said, "Hey, Rick, I got this version of Dream Lover, man," and I started playing it, and Rick sang it, and it sounded so good. So it sounds pretty much like that record. You know?
Yeah.
I try to stay true to it.
It
you
sound,
know?
Sounded like Ricky Nelson.
It was his last hit record, yeah. You know.
Well, I wanted to, by the way, folks, if you just tuned in, my guest this morning is John Beeland, and he is a musician and a singer and a writer, a arranger, and he's played with some of the more popular people that you've heard of over the last 50 years or so. We're doing a little name dropping, which is always a lot of fun.
Sure.
I have my own story about Ricky Nelson that I've told probably 3 or 4 times over the last 15 years on this station. But you do have a story, and of course, you're a little bit closer, and I don't want to believe that the airplane went down while snorting cocaine.
No, I tell you what, first and foremost, Rick was the most professional guy I think I've ever worked with. He was brought up that way by his mom and dad, and so I knew that it was all baloney when it happened. What made that whole thing just so sad was that I left Ricky back in 1980 to join this group. And I had always missed working with Ricky. I hated to leave, but I had a really good opportunity for me. And Rick was really supportive, and he said, go for it. So Rick and I split up in 80. And then in 1985, he called me back. I was living in Nashville, and he asked if I wanted to come back with him because the guitar player who had taken my place was leaving to go back home to Memphis. And I jumped at the chance. I said, oh, yeah, I'd love to. So I started packing up, and my wife and I found a house back in Los Angeles. We were in Nashville at the time. And we got ready to join Rick, and I was going to join him right after the Christmas tour. And then the crash happened, and everybody that I knew in the band was killed, and so I kind of took it as a sign that maybe I should stay in Nashville and stay where I belong for a while, and I did, and I went on to work with a lot of hit artists after that. But I would have probably joined Rick a week after when the crash happened.
Well, tell me the story, because I always thought it was a great gotcha, kind of a sad but glad tune, and that, of course, is Garden Party.
Yeah.
Tell me what you know about behind
that
story.
Well, the real story on it is, the kind of made-up story is the fact that people were booing Ricky, so he went to Madison Square Garden against his better judgment. He never wanted to be clumped into an oldies act. Like, he didn't want to be Fabian or any of that stuff, because he was a well-respected artist with his country rock band, the Stone Canyon Band. And he was trying to break away from that image of teenage idol. And anyway, he took this gig at Madison Square Garden, and it was an oldies gig. I forget, Chuck Berry and all of them were on the bill. And he came out to play, and people started booing and stuff. At that time, Rick's hair was pretty long and shoulder length, and he was wearing a fringe jacket, and he didn't really...
Not the image he had on Ozzie and Harriet.
No. And so people started booing, and then it was kind of a bad scene for Rick, and he ended up writing Garden Party as kind of his answer to all of that. That he just didn't want to be seen. If all he was going to be seen was as an oldies act, he'd rather drive a truck. Well, the real thing that happened at that show was that the PA system was cutting out, and people were booing the PA guy because they was cutting out while Rick was singing. But Rick took it as they were booing him, you know. Oh. So that's kind of how that happened. And Rick
did he owe anybody an apology?
No. I think Rick did tell me that he noticed that a lot of people were kind of like they wanted him. They would have preferred him to come out and dressed up in a really neat jacket and all of that.
But, the image that he had portrayed on TV.
But he ironically went back to playing the old hits when I joined him, you know. And
why not?
Why not?
But I always was under the impression that the other acts were the ones that were dissing him.
Oh, no. They were all friends of Rick's. Chuck Berry and we worked with Chuck quite a few times. And they were good friends. Those rock and roll guys, they were like a fraternity, you know. They were all pretty much supportive of each other. I never really heard any squabbling between acts. One guy I did. One act I'll never forget was a bit of a problem. He was in the car with us when we were driving to Baltimore. And that was Freddie Cannon.
Oh,
you remember him? Down at Palisades Park. He had just kind of this, I'll just say, an acquired taste personality, you know, and very New York, Brooklyn, in your face attitude. And he just wouldn't shut up in the car. And he was really bummed out because Link Wray was on the bill with us.
Guitar.
And he got top billing because they were playing in Baltimore and everybody knew Link Wray. So they put him at the top of the billing. And Freddie Cannon didn't like it, and he was moaning and moaning in the car. And I was in the back seat with Tillotson, and Link was driving the car, and it was snowing out. And it's farm country between Washington, D.C. and Baltimore. And so Freddie Cannon's going on and on. You know, well, you know, I should be, you know, I mean, I'm the guy with the hits. And Link Wray is like this rough and tumble look kind of guy, you know, and he's driving. You could see him holding his composure, you know. And finally, you know, the Link slams on the brakes and the car skids and we go off to the side of the road and gets out of the car and he goes to the driver's side, or passenger side, and he pulls Freddie Cannon out and he leaves him there to the side of the road and we went on to Baltimore. I don't know how Freddie Cannon ever got to the gig, but he had had enough, you know, and so.
Well, you're mentioning Rick Link Wray.
Yeah.
Of course, the man.
Rumble.
Was, Mm-hmm. But the man on guitar in my era was Duane Eddy.
Oh, Duane, yeah.
My name is Wayne Eddy.
That's the first thing I thought when I heard your name. Yeah. Well, I was a Duane Eddy fan. Snuff Garrett, who produced all of Duane's hits, was my publisher. But I grew up really liking Duane Eddy. I couldn't imagine how he got that sound. That guitar sounded like it was 10 times, you know, big. And I always wondered how he did that until I wised up and I learned how to play guitar and figured it out. But Duane Eddy, and he's still out there playing, you know.
I was talking to somebody the other day that knows the guy. I've never met him.
Yeah.
But I do have a fun story. I was visiting, lobbying, or whatever you want to call it, Washington, D.C., with Senator Dave Durenberger. And we were left the cafeteria for breakfast, and we're going to go up to the his office. And when the elevator came, Ted Kennedy was right there.
Oh, wow, great.
And Ted Kennedy, big man. Big
hands.
Oh, yeah,
hands. Definitely.
And he had a tie on, but it was loose. His neck's real big. Yeah. And I had said to myself after reading about Chappaquiddick, that, boy, I've got a piece of my mind I'd like to give him. And there he is.
Yeah, right.
And so am I going to be true to myself or am I going to? So Durenberger says, Ted, I want you to meet Wayne Eddy. And he said, oh, Dwayne Eddy, yeah, Rebel Rouser. And I said, yes, sir. And then he goes, boing, boing. And I go, bum, 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 well, bum, bum, bum.
You can't hate a guy that knows Dwayne Eddy.
So all the way up the elevator, we're doing the Rebel Rouser. And we get off, and I say to Durenberger, I said, you know, I wanted to say something about Chappaquiddick. And he said, well, that wouldn't be the proper protocol in the senator's elevators.
I just don't think it would have been proper protocol after talking about Dwayne Eddy.
Yeah. You know, it was fun, though. I mean, I got a kick out of it. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back, and we are talking to a gentleman by the name of John Beeland. And John is a performer, and he's performing tonight at the Northfield Arts Guild. I believe we have about a dozen tickets left, and they'll be sold out, and it's for a very good cause. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, I'm Angie Taylor, Director of Life Enrichment at Three Links Care Center in Northfield. We offer daily activities at each of our facilities, including independent senior living, assisted living, care center, and memory care. The activities range from exercise classes to sing-alongs, games to gardening, from bus rides in the countryside to painting fine art. Activities are personalized for the individual. Please call Three Links at 664-8800 or find out more at threelinks.org.
This is Twins first baseman Joe Mauer, the legendary legend of legend, baseball son of the Twin Cities. Minnesota lore foretold of his greatness, and it couldn't have been more correct. He stands among us today, part myth, part man, all Minnesotan, all-star, five-time Silver Slugger, three-time Gold Glover, MVP, and one hell of a nice guy. That is Joe Mauer. This is How We Baseball. Get your tickets to see Mauer and the Twins at twinsbaseball.com.
I saw these guys a number of times in L.A. when I lived there. They were playing at the Whiskey all the time, Whiskey Go-Go. And, they were like the local neighborhood band. Wow.
This song was number 8 in all of 1987, performed by The Doors.
Right, Jim Morrison.
Come on, baby, light my fire.
Yeah. It's funny because I didn't know what light my fire meant. I was so straight and green when I first started in the business, it's ridiculous.
What does it mean?
Light my fire would be like lighting a joint, I guess.
Never thought of that.
There you go.
Yeah. I thought he was...
Here I am telling you about the button.
Yeah. Give me a kiss. I want to, you know, that's what I thought it was about.
No,
get
come
me
on,
going.
Baby. Light my fire. Couldn't get much higher.
Oh, you know? Of course. You know? Oh, man.
I love that movie that Val Kilmer played, Jim Morrison, in The Doors movie. It was a great, great film.
My guest this morning is a fellow by the name of John Beeland. He's been all over the world performing for many audiences. What was your biggest venue that you performed either as a lead or open or support?
The biggest venue I played, a couple really big ones, but I think the most important one for me was Carnegie Hall. I was about 21. And that was an honor because it was such a struggle to get in the business, and I had put my family through a lot of grief and worry and concern, and so I was able to. I played Carnegie Hall and with Arlo Guthrie, and I called my parents up from backstage, and I said, "I'm getting ready to go on stage at Carnegie Hall.
Wow.
And what do you think?" And it was very emotional, and so I walked up to the stage, and the curtain was closed. I could hear the audience through the curtain. But I thought when the curtain opened, it would be an audience like you would see in the 1940s movies, you know, top hats and, you know, tuxedos.
Oh, really?
The curtain opened up. It was tie-dye T-shirts, and they were throwing Frisbees around. But it was still Carnegie Hall. So, but I've been fortunate. I've worked the Hollywood Bowl, Carnegie Hall, the Wembley Stadium, then the Grand Ole Opry's, and you name it, every place from the Bitter End to the Carnegie Hall.
Did you ever work with the Beach Boys?
Yeah, I did. I had an offer to join their band in 1970. I did the second Monterey Pop Festival when I was with Linda Ronstadt, and the Beach Boys were on the bill. And I'm a Beach Boy, absolutely fanatic. I know all of their music. And I got a call from their road manager about playing the guitar in their band. But at the time, I was with Linda Ronstadt. And at that time in 1970, Linda Ronstadt was a lot more hipper than the Beach Boys were. The Beach Boys were pretty much at a lull. But on this show that we did with them, I watched from the wings, you know. They were great. They were, you know, they just had that great harmony sound, and I was such a fan.
The arrangements were out of this world.
Brian Wilson, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, and then the top session players in the business played on those records. And so I kind of regretted that I never took the offer, but the acts that I was playing with at the time were considered a little bit more hipper at the, for the period.
When I first heard Good Vibrations,
yeah,
I thought, wow.
Me too.
What a mix master.
I couldn't believe it when I heard it. I kept thinking that, who put this together? How did they do that?
You know?
And it's actually, I guess that song was made up of a number of various recording sessions and, you know, stuck together and everything. So,
have you ever, I'll get it later. I want to know, you have four or five siblings?
Yeah, I have.
Who's the oldest in your family?
I am.
Okay, you are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then after you, who is it?
After it is my brother, who is also a songwriter and recording artist in Los Angeles.
What's his name?
Bob.
Bob, I don't know. I was ready to write Bob. I don't know
Bob Beeland, and he's 3 years younger than me.
Okay, minus three.
And then I have my brother Tom, who is a very famous award-winning cartoonist. His name is Tom Beeland, and he's how old would Tom be now? He'd be like 55 or 56.
How much younger?
He's about the rest of the kids are about 10 years younger than me. My brother and I were about 10 years older than the other kids. You know?
Okay,
so they're all they're all from another generation, but
yeah.
They're all doing good. Yeah, Tom draws for Spider-Man and the Simpsons comic books, and we come from a family of cartoonists. I was going to be one, and my dad was one. And
I had a cartoonist on the air. And he has done some great cartoons, and you'd know what his work.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know his name,
mm-hmm.
And I can't remember it, of course. But anyhow, that's a pretty good industry.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you. On Sunday, you get the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a kid, you'd read the funny papers.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And now they call it the cart. No, what did they call it now?
Comics or
the comic section.
The comic section.
But we call them the funny papers.
Oh, I couldn't wait to get them. Or you can watch it into Dick Tracy and all of the. That was a big deal on Sundays to grab the comic in a big family like mine to grab it before the others grabbed it.
Yeah.
But we grew up knowing about comics and comic book artists from my dad, you know, and he was a great artist, and that's what I wanted to be until music came along and destroyed my life.
Yeah, I can imagine you've had your ups and your downs.
Yeah.
We're going to come back after the news next, all right?
Okay, great.
Our guest this morning is John Beeland, and he'll be performing tonight at the NAG Theater, and I think you'll find his music great, and you'll find the stories he has to tell very interesting. You're listening to The One, 95.1 FM, Northfield, Minnesota, KYMN, 1080 AM radio, since 1968, our 50th anniversary on September 27th.
Missing student, grim admission. I'm John Trout. Investigators believe they have found the body of a University of Iowa student who's been missing for more than a month. Mike Moss is following details.
John, Greg Willey from Crime Stoppers in Iowa says a body found early today is believed to be that of Molly Tibbetts. The 20-year-old was last seen more than a month ago while out jogging. A $400,000 reward for finding her will now become available for information on finding a suspect.
In Colorado, new information in the Christopher Watts murder allegations. Watts suggesting he didn't kill the children.
An unsealed arrest affidavit shows Watts said he went into a rage as his wife was killing one of their daughters, then he strangled his wife to death. The exact causes of death have not been released yet, nor a reason why Watts then hid the bodies on the property of the nearby oil company where Watts used to work.
There's Jim Roop. Deliberations continue as the jury attempts to reach a verdict in the financial fraud trial of Paul Manafort, Donald Trump's one-time campaign manager. Jessica Schneider is following that case.
They've said several times now that the longer this jury takes deliberating, the better the chances are for Paul Manafort to be acquitted in this case. But really, this is a very complicated case. This is a financial crimes trial, 18 complicated counts.
Ahead of U.S. midterm midterm elections, Microsoft says it's uncovered new intrusions by Russian government-linked hackers on U.S. political groups. The Kremlin denies the allegations. Correspondent Fred Plykin is investigating the story.
I'm actually at one of Russia's largest military fairs right now, where the Russians plan to display their stealth fighter jet, which is the Russian answer to the F-22 and the F-35. Of course, another way that the Russians are looking to challenge the U.S.
The last known Nazi war criminal in America is gone. ICE agents arrested Paliv Yakiv at his home in Queens, New York yesterday. The 95-year-old's been deported to Germany. I'm John Trout.
Get it?
When I was 64.
Yeah. Started in 1964.
Yeah,
started
that's
doing
right.
this show when
that's
I was
definitely
64.
Your theme, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Many years and I let it play up until that part.
Sure. I've got a Beatles story I'll tell you later.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Welcome back to the Wayne Eddy Affair on KYMN Radio, the 195.1. John Beelan is my guest this morning. He'll be appearing tonight at the Northfield Arts Guild. You don't want to miss it. He's a great guitar player and a musician and a writer and a producer and an arranger and a singer and has worked with many, many people around the world. And he's dropping names that I'm going, hey, that's my music. But I guess when it comes to the greatest group ever, you can't drop names on the Beatles.
Well, the Beatles played a big part in my career. I was in 1973 while I was on tour in England with Johnny Tillotson. We were on tour with Del Shannon and Bobby V. And while we were in Birmingham, Johnny Tillotson said to me, he said, you know, John, I know you've been recording solo stuff. Do you have any of that with you? And I said, yeah, I have it on a cassette. He says, good. Because I just made an appointment for you to go to Apple Records, the Beatles company, and my friend Tony King is the manager now at the label, and he wants to hear it. And I went, are you kidding me? The Beatles label? He said, yeah, and I thought he was joking, but then he was serious. So the next day I took the cab down to London and went to the Beatles label, which was the building where they did their last concert on the roof.
Yeah.
And went inside and took the elevator up, and there was Tony King. And all the walls are covered with gold records, as you can imagine. And when I went in the office, Tony King was there, and a very nice English gentleman, and he played my tape and he loved it, and Ringo was coming in that night, and so he was going to play it for Ringo to see if they would be interested in having me on the label as an artist. And the next day, I went back to Birmingham, and the next morning I got a call from Tony, and he played it for Ringo, and they wanted to know if I wanted to sign with Apple Records, which I said, of course. And so the next day we all went down to London. My manager flew out from New York, and I signed with the Beatles. And I was the last artist signed to the Beatles record company, Apple Records.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And James Taylor was the first. And I talked to James when he played Minneapolis. I've known him for a long time, and we were talking about how between the two of us, we closed down the Beatles record label.
Well, whatever happened to that song?
Well, I went back to America, and I did.
By the way, when you said Birmingham, that's England.
Yeah, in England, yeah. I went back to America and finished, resumed the recording of the album. I had made an album deal. And halfway through the album, Apple Records and the folded because of litigation the Beatles were having with their manager at the time. And so I got my contract back, and I got a deal right off the bat with Scepter Records out of New York. And I finished the album for Scepter. And, yeah, you can still find it floating around out there. It's on iTunes under John Edward Beeland. And I did it in 1973. Yeah. So 1972 is when the Apple. But for me to walk in that door.
Oh my goodness!
I mean, that was like, you know.
By the way, that when I'm 64, the clarinet solo. Mm-hmm. That's Paul McCartney's dad. Did you know that?
Oh yeah, James McCartney.
Yeah,
yeah. That's really. You know, Paul's stepmother Angie is a good friend of mine, and she has a little internet radio show on every Tuesday called Tuesday Tea Flicks with Angie McCartney. And she's the sweetest. She's the sweetest lady. So the Beatles were obviously a huge influence with me. I mean, they were on me. So just to be acknowledged by them was an incredible, you know.
Did you ever get involved in the San Francisco scene?
No, I never cared for it, to be honest with you. I always thought that for the most part, they were just a bunch of stoned out musicians that just jammed, and they just in Los Angeles, where I came from, the Troubadour Club, we thought we were, you know, more refined than the guys up in San Francisco. But I played up there. I played the Fillmore West, and
oh, that's big time.
And I did, I did a number of shows. I'll tell you what I did like up in San Francisco, though. I loved John Fogerty and Creedence, and I also loved the Vince Guaraldi, the jazz pianist. He came from there too, and I want to
give people an opportunity to hear your writing or your singing.
Sure.
Or both. I have your album here.
Yeah.
What cut would you like me to play?
Well, I'll play you one that's one here. You know, I worked on the original version of City of New Orleans with Arlo Guthrie.
Uh-huh.
And
you
so,
had that?
Yeah, I had track number five.
Oh, good.
So
let's play that. I like that.
Written by my friend, the late Stevie Goodman.
Okay, let's do it. Ladies and gentlemen, live from our studio, but on a CD, here is
live.
John Beeland on KYMN.
Riding on the city of New Orleans, Illinois Central Monday morning rail. 15 cars, 15 restless riders, 3 conductors, 25 sacks of mail. All along the southbound Odyssey, the train pulls out of Kankakee, rolls along past houses, farms and fields, passing trains that have no names, freight yards full of old black men, and the graveyards of the rusted automobiles. Good morning, America, how are you? Saying, don't you know me? I'm your native son. I am the train they call the City of New Orleans. I'll be gone 500 miles before the day's done. Dealing cargoes with the old man in the club car. Penny point, ain't no one keeping score. Pass the paper bag that holds the bottle, and feel the wheels rumbling beneath the floor. And the sons of Pullman porters and the sons of engineers ride their father's magic carpet made of steel. Mothers with their babes asleep are rocking to the gentle beat, and the rhythm of the rain is all they feel. Good morning, America, how are you? Say, don't you know me? I'm your native son. I am the train they call the City of New Orleans. I'll be gone 500 miles for the day's done. Nighttime on the City of New Orleans. Changing cars in Memphis, Tennessee. Halfway home, we'll be there by morning. Through the Mississippi darkness, rolling down to the sea. But all the towns and people seem to fade into a bad dream. And the steel rail still ain't heard the news. The conductor sings his song again, past
passengers will please refrain. This train's got the disappearing railroad blues. Well, good morning, America, how are you? Saying, don't you know me? I'm your native son. I am the train they call the city. Miles for the day is done.
Some pretty good guitar work on this.
Yeah, well, I've been playing it long enough. I better be good at it. Yeah. It's paying the rent.
All right. That was John Beeland, and John is in studio with me right now. He's from hometown Illinois originally, Los Angeles, Memphis, Nashville, Texas. And, you've led a troubadour's life. Do you have a wife and children or children? Or?
I have children. I have five children, three girls.
Five.
Three,
wow.
Three girls and two boys, and the two boys are in the business. Well, my son, Chris Beeland, is a recording artist with a big following out in California, and my son, Tyler, is a recording engineer, and he does hip-hop music. And then I have three daughters, and they're all very equally talented, and yeah.
Are you one of those guys that had kids before you were 20 or 21?
I had, my first daughter was when I was 20.
So yeah. Guess how old she is.
Yeah, are you going to remind me right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, I want to know.
I think she's probably 40, 45.
Well, are you 65?
I'm a 69.
I think she might be a little older than that.
Oh, boy, now I'm really depressed.
What I'm trying to do is saying that your oldest daughter is almost 50.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
I mean, we're sitting here reminiscing,
and
thinking
you know,
back.
When I talk to her, I talk to her all the time, and she's still like a little kid when I talk to her. I feel like she's still, you know, that little girl. And they're all.
I did that today with my daughter.
Isn't it weird?
Yeah. Before I came in, I was doing that.
And they probably look at us and think, like, God, Dad's still doing music. I can't believe it. You know?
Well, too bad she didn't know that we're streaming, and she could have been listening
right
now.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, she would have loved that. Yeah. No, I'm really proud of my kids. They're all great. They're all great people. They're the kind of people that I like to hang out with. And I'm very proud of them. I never wanted or never encouraged them to get into the business. My sons took it up on their own, and they learned how to play instruments, and they learned their craft on their own through other people, not me. But my son Tyler grew up in Nashville with all of the stars. I had a studio at the house where I produced a lot of my music. And I had a lot of stars at the house, like from Garth Brooks to you name it. And he grew up with that, but it never really mattered to him. He was just an opie kind of kid, you know, and I liked him that way. And so he found his way to music on his own.
Tyler.
Yeah, Tyler.
Is that part of the book?
Yes, it is. Oh, yeah.
By the way, do you have a book?
Yeah, I have which is part of the reason I'm on the road now. I have a book called, a brand new book, and it's called Best Seat in the House. And it's just killing it on Amazon. We're doing great. We've got 15... readers' reviews, and they're all across the board. It's five stars.
Wow!
And if you like, you know, the stories of all these acts that we grew up with, well, I was there with many of them when they first started and first came up on the scene, which makes it kind of really exciting. And there's a lot of photos from my own personal collection that you haven't seen before. The Eagles, before they were the Eagles, Christofferson and I. And it's a journey. It's a trip about my career of going from hometown Illinois to Hollywood to Nashville, playing Carnegie Hall, the Opry, writing hit records, playing on recording sessions, and following the music. And it's really, for me, we were just talking. I mean, I still can't believe I've been fortunate enough to have been able to do all of that, you know. A lot of it was luck. A lot of it was being in the right place at the right time. I'd like to say I was a brilliant talent, but as you know, in this business, it's all where you are. And I mean, once you get your foot crack in the door, an opportunity knocks, then talent kind of has to kick in then. But it really is chance and luck and guardian angels and all of that. And it, for me, it all came my way. And I'm still doing it at 69 years old, and I still love it, and I've never gotten tired of it. So it keeps me young, and you can't be – how lucky can you and I be, you know?
Well, you're wearing a hat.
Yeah, Capitol Studios, where I spend a lot of time.
No, I'm wondering what's underneath the hat.
Oh, yeah, what's underneath the hat? My three daughters and my two sons.
Okay.
talking about a receding hairline. Yeah
but, well, I know all about those.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
it's 10:17 on the Wayne Eddy Affair. John Beelen is my guest on Kim, a friend you can count on. He wrote a book called Front Row Seats.
Best Seat in the House.
Okay, mm-hmm. Best Seat in the House. And how many, did you bring a copy?
I don't know if we brought a copy. I'll have to ask my road manager, Doug. I think he may have brought one in for you. Well, I'll ask him. I'm sure
I'm self-centered and egotistical, and I want to, when I pass away, when they're going through stuff and mm-hmm. they come to my book section.
Yeah, they'll say, there's Best Seat in the House. I'll be darned.
They'll say, oh, Wayne knew this guy. Yeah. Wayne knew that guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
If that will happen.
I'll have a copy for you. It's an easy read, too. It's not geared for, technical details and equipment. And all. It's geared, really, the focus of the book is the journey and how exciting it was to be with, all of a sudden you're there with Linda Ronstadt in 1970 on stage at the Troubadour, and out in the audience are future Eagles and John Lennon and the Smothers Brothers, and then going from that to a struggling Kris Kristofferson and me before anybody knew who he was, and just him and I, and Mac Davis, Dolly Parton.
Mac Davis.
Yeah, well, I did In the Ghetto, actually, on the album. I was with Mac in 1977 and did Vegas and all of the gigs with him. And
God, I'm trying to think of his biggest hit. That
Stop and Smell the Roses, I Believe in Music.
No, and about I'm Great, I'm the Best.
Oh, it's Hard to be Humble.
Oh, Lord, it's hard to be humble.
That's pretty much Mac.
I like that. But you know something? That song, Stop and Smell the Roses.
Oh, yeah.
True story. I was on my motorcycle over on the east side. On, I believe, Nevada, and our local listeners will know where I'm talking about. And there was this rose bush I would pass every day. And that song, back then, you didn't have radios on your motorcycle.
No, it'd be kind of hard.
And I did. I stopped and smelled the roses. Yeah, and I thought, that's so true. It just put a little spring in your step.
Played with Mac in Vegas, for quite a while in the late 70s. And when my daughter Jessie was born in Los Angeles, I was on stage with Mac getting ready to play In the Ghetto. And before we did In the Ghetto, it was just me and Mac in a string section. And before I started the song, he said, before I continue, this was at the MGM Grand, he said, before I continue, I just want to tell my guitar player that he's a brand new father of a baby girl, out in Los Angeles. And it didn't register with me, I kept tuning the guitar and getting ready to. Yeah. Then I went, what? And he says, your wife just had the baby, Jesse. And I was in shock, and my guitar fell off my lap into the audience. And the first guy in the first row grabbed it, gave it back to me, and the crowd all applauded. And Max said, well, listen, John, if you're too shook up to do the song right now, maybe you should get back to Los Angeles and leave now. And I told Mac, I said, no, that's okay, Mac, I'll finish the tune, and I started the first couple notes of In the Ghetto, and the guitar was so out of tune, it was terrible. I just picked the guitar up and walked off stage, and Mac flew me back to Los Angeles.
No, you kind of suggested he might have been self-centered.
Well, he was a bit I don't know, with Mac, he could be the kindest guy to work for and just the loveliest. I mean, he really did some beautiful things for me when my father was ill with cancer, and he just treated my dad at one of the gigs like a king. I never forgot that. But then Mac could be kind of a show off, I guess, if there were a lot of women in the room or whatever. And for a while, he was saying a lot of jokes about Elvis Presley every night on stage, and fat jokes. And the crew at the MGM Grand didn't appreciate it. And so finally, they sent a guy to the dressing room to tell Mac, just say, listen, we're not going to work for you if you say any more fat jokes, because they loved Elvis in Vegas. I mean, he knew all the backstage hands. So Mac kind of cooled it a little bit, and then I had to go on stage with Mac at the MGM Grand Vegas and sing and play In the Ghetto the night Elvis died, the day Elvis died.
Well, wasn't In the Ghetto his song?
Yeah, he wrote it. Mac wrote it. And
Mac wrote it, but mm-hmm. didn't Elvis Presley make it popular?
Absolutely, and it was because of Elvis. Mac had a career, really.
Yeah.
And so for him to make those jokes was, I thought, was really kind of crummy. But
should we play that tune?
Yeah, I have In the Ghetto here. I have my version of it, and it's the same.
The same words?
Yes. Oh, yeah, it's the same. It's the exact same way that I did it with Mac.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So we should listen to the words, because when you say In the Ghetto, you're thinking of... The Ghetto.
That's what it is, and it's one of the most well-written songs I've ever heard.
Is he from the ghetto?
No, but he just wrote about what it's like. And this song really applies today to like what's going on in Chicago. And, it's really a hard-hitting tune.
What number?
It's cut number 8. Okay. And by the way, if you like these songs, they're on a CD that I'll be having at the gig tonight. So and the book.
Okay. Well, I'm one of the. I have to explain this, and you maybe understand this. Mm-hmm. Back in the old days, when you queued up a record, queued up a tape, queued up a cart, queued up a cassette, you know the opening and you know the closing, but you don't know the middle because you're busy doing things.
Yeah, that's right. You're getting weather reports and doing all of this. Yeah.
So I didn't listen to the words, and now I have a chance to listen to
the words.
It's
one of the most
words.
Beautiful songs I ever wrote.
Well, I've never paid attention to it.
I hope
except
you like it.
In the Ghetto. Well, you know we're going to be chatting while it's playing, so, but I certainly will give it a try.
Okay.
Here it is, ladies and gentlemen, on KYMN Radio, not live performing, but live in the studio, the performer, John Beeland, In the Ghetto.
As a snow flies on a cold and gray Chicago morning, a poor little baby child is born in the ghetto. And his mama cries, for if there's one thing that she don't need, it's another little hungry mouth to feed in the ghetto. People, don't you understand? A child needs a helping hand, or he'll grow to be an angry young man one day. Take a look at you and me. Are we too blind to see? Or do we simply turn our heads and look the other way? Well, the world turns, and the hungry little boy with the runny nose plays in the street as a cold wind blows in the ghetto. And his hunger burns, so he learns to walk the streets at night. He learns how to steal, learns how to fight in the ghetto. Then one night in desperation, the young boy breaks away. He buys a gun, steals a car, tries to run, but it don't get far. And his mama cries as the crowd gathers round an angry young man face down in the street with a gun in his hand in the ghetto. And as her young boy dies on a cold and gray Chicago morning, another little baby child is born in the ghetto. Cries.
In the Ghetto on KYMN Radio is performed by John Beeland, who happens to be right across the table from me.
Pretty powerful song.
Oh, yeah. I never listened to the words.
When you think about what's going on today down there, I mean, it still goes on and on and on.
Whoever produced that. The drums are really dramatic.
Yeah, I did that. I produced it, and it's a timpani. But that's what Elvis used, too. He used the same thing. Kind of gets the emotion going. But, yeah, Mac was a great writer. He's written some really terrific tunes. But out of all of the tunes, that's my favorite that he wrote.
Well, you have many stories, and you'll be telling them tonight at the Northfield Arts Guild and performing. And I was hoping you would have brought your guitar, but you mentioned that you like classic guitar.
Yeah, well, I play when I'm home off the road. I play kind of a Chet Atkins instrumental classical guitar, but I do standards. You know, I do stuff like Cast Your Fate to the Wind and all sorts of tunes from the 50s and 60s. Just no effects or gimmicks or anything. It's just me and the guitar. And I work mostly little wineries or bistros where people are listening and having wine and adults are there. And it's really relaxing for me because normally I've got an electric guitar strapped to me or I'm doing sessions with the other guitars. But it's a relaxing thing for me.
What are your guitars of choice?
Well, I've been known, I guess, if I'm known for anything, for playing a Fender Telecaster, and that's the guitar I've played behind, you know, people like Ricky and Nelson and Linda Ronstadt and all those people. But I have a guitar that I've carried with me for years and years, and it's a Guild acoustic guitar, and I use that record. I wrote some country hits on it, and I've also used that on Garth Brooks' record Friends in Low Places and the Bellamy Brothers hits, and so I've had that guitar with me now for about, I guess, 35 years now.
Now, for those that aren't aware of it, if your kid goes down to Nashville and he cuts a record,
right?
The people that are making money are the people that wrote it.
Right.
And the people, our studio sessions, get
players.
Paid, and then they're done with it. There's no more.
Yeah.
And then, of course, a little bit goes to the actual performer.
Yeah, not much.
Yeah, but that builds a name, and then people come to see you at a concert.
It's hopefully be a vehicle for their career, you know. You know, when I got into the business, my heroes were recording session guys that nobody even heard about, you know, but I knew about it from reading about them. And I wanted to do what Glenn Campbell did. I wanted to play on the hits. I wanted to be the guy that comes into the studio with the coffee and the cigarettes and sits down with the guitar and plays on the hit and then moves on to the next hit and the next hit. I didn't want to be in a rock band. I didn't want to tour. The recording studio was my life. It still is. That was my world, you know, the creating something that would actually had a chance on getting on the radio. And then when it did, it was a euphoric feeling, you know, and to see another person's career take off on the wings of a session that maybe I played on. Oh, man, you know, that doesn't get better than that.
I interviewed a gal one time, and she was performing at the local county fair, and she wasn't really tall. And she had big blonde hair, and she had other big things about her.
I think I know where you're going with this.
Did you ever have an opportunity to work with her? No.
With Ollie?
Yeah.
She's one of my dearest friends.
Good.
I worked with her last year in Nashville. I was Dolly's guitar player, and I was also a dear friend of hers ever since 1978. I was on tour with Mac Davis, and Dolly was her opening act. And not many people knew of Dolly Parton back then. And I hung out with her on that tour, and we became really great friends. And when the tour was over with and we all came back to L.A., I quit Mac and I joined Dolly, much to Mac's chagrin. He wasn't very happy about it. But playing with her, she became a dear friend of mine. The sweetest, most unaffected person I have ever met in the music business.
Intelligent.
And I can truly say how much I love her because anybody who knows Dolly personally would say the same thing because she's the real deal. I'll give an example. She, once my cousin, he was handicapped, and his mother died, my godmother, and he was so distraught about it. He had Down syndrome, my cousin Brian, and when his mom died, you know, he was just beside himself. And I called Dolly because Brian was a big country music fan, and I was kind of a hero to him, you know. And I told Dolly that about it, and I said, Dolly, he'd like to have a picture. Can you send him a picture? And Dolly didn't send him a picture. She sent him a truck full of jackets, hats, tons of stuff came into hometown to his house, you know. And she's just the most incredibly thoughtful person there is. And if anybody thinks that she's a dumb blonde, you don't know anything.
I was just saying.
She's one of the smartest, most articulate women. She's country, you know. But she's as smart as can be. She manages her whole career. She's that whole career that she has been planned by her, and she knows exactly what she's doing. And she's probably, and I've played with the great singers in this business, but I think technically Dolly's probably the most perfect singer that I've ever worked with. I've never heard her ever come near a bad note, and on stage she projects so incredibly. The only thing is, to this day, I still don't know how she plays guitar with those really long fingernails that she has, you know. But I love her to death. She's just one in a million.
Imagine my thought when I got on this bus. Nowadays, they're not like the buses they use today.
This was when a bus was a bus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And doing an interview with her before her show.
Right.
Imagine what I thought when I first saw her.
Oh, she's an eyeful.
I mean, I didn't ever.
I mean, personality-wise, too. Yeah. She just takes over the room.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I didn't know who she was, and she wasn't anybody at that time.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I go, wow, you know, almost intimidating, you know.
Yeah, well, it is. Yeah, but I guarantee you, she's just like she is now.
Amen.
You know, than she was when you met her. And she never forgets things, and I was honored that she mentioned me in her book. You know, I never thought that she was going to.
How did she mention
people that were important to her in the beginning when she started? And,
wow!
And for me, I was very touched by that. And then I've got a radio show that I'm putting together. I did the pilot episode in Nashville last year, and it's called Best Seat in the House. It's me interviewing the people that I've worked with. And Dolly did the pilot episode. She came down for nothing, and we did it at the recording studio. And at the end of the show, the two of us played her song "Coat of Many Colors" together for the first time in like 30 years. You know,
Do you know whether people that appear not necessarily on radio, mm-hmm. but on various interview shows?
Right.
Are they compensated for that, or?
Oh no, I don't think so. I've never heard of people that do. Well, you know, when I was playing backup with the different acts, and we would do like the Tonight, because I've done the Tonight Show, Merv Griffin, Mike Douglas, all those shows from the '70s. We would get a union check. You know, you'd get
as a musician.
Yeah, as a musician, but the stars don't because it's a promo tool. You know.
Yeah.
And I don't think they do. I know when I joined the Flying Burrito Brothers, like the group. We had about 6 country hits, and so we did that circuit of country syndicated country shows with like Tom T. Hall and being the host and
Tom T. Hall.
Yeah,
is that the snake guy?
No, this is the guy that wrote Harper Valley PTA and anyway, they would have these shows with hosts, and you would come on, you'd lip sync your song and get off. Anyway, when you have a hit record, you do that circuit, you know, and you do all of these shows. A lot of these shows are broadcast in small little towns across the country. The Porter Wagoner show that Dolly started on. And but you never got any money for it. I mean, you know, you show up with a change of shirts. And.
Well, the reason I asked that is that you said that she came down and did it for nothing. I've never heard of a radio personality.
Well, let me tell you this: when I did the Flying Burrito Brothers last album that I produced in 1979, I flew all over the country because we had special guests on the album, and I was producing the session. And that year, I produced Merle Haggard, Buck Owens, Waylon Jennings, and who else there was? The Oak Ridge Boys. And they all came down to guest on the album, and none of them took a penny.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, say those names again.
Waylon Jennings.
Okay, now say another name.
Buck Owens.
I've got a tiger by the tail.
It's plain to see. And they're going to put me in the movies.
Yep. You
know? And then I did, yeah, the Waylon Jennings, Buck Owens, Merle Haggard.
And you know, Okie from?
Okie from Muskogee, Merle Haggard. And then I did the Oak Ridge Boys, who were a very big country.
Elvira?
Country Elvira.
Okay.
And all these guys, I had known all these people from years and years of sharing bills with them, you know. So when I did the album, I just called them up and asked if they would like the guest on the album sing maybe a chorus or something, or one or so. I'm sure, John. But so I had to. I flew out to Merle's house and spent 2 days there with him, and up in Redding, California. And then I flew to Bakersfield and went into Buck had his studio in Bakersfield, and I went and recorded him. And the outtakes that I have from Buck's session are so funny. But if I played them for you right now, you'd be off the air. And
FCC wouldn't appreciate it.
See, it was great. Yeah.
You're helping me bring back memories. Many years ago at WTMB, I was the first voice on their FM, 100,000 watts.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. I'd like to own that today.
No kidding.
And anyhow, they're at that county fair in Mauston County, I think it is. The gal from the TV show that wore the hat with the price.
Minnie Pearl
was performing.
Yeah.
And, of course, I learned from that boss that I worked for that he would sell things on the spot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so he'd go up and he'd find somebody at the fair and say, hey, I'm going to put a mic up there and we're going to have Minnie Pearl on our new FM station, and you can sponsor, and right there on the spot, you know. And the guy would say, oh, wow, okay, I'll do that. You call the studio and say, we had a radio transmission, and they'd say, get ready, we're going to do the Minnie Pearl show. Well, she held up the show because she didn't know if he is allowed to do that based on unions.
Oh,
and he was not going to give her any money. This was going to be a live broadcast from our local county fair, after all, and for
she wanted some bucks.
And
sure.
And finally, this guy, Hugh Dickey was his name. He's dead now, but anyhow, he ended up doing it, and so we were broadcasting live with Minnie Pearl.
Yeah,
I thought that was so cool.
That is neat.
I never heard of her before.
Yeah, Minnie Pearl was one of the original stars of the Grand Ole Opry, and she was the first female comedian in the grand country music comedian. And she was a sweetheart. I knew her really well. Like I did a lot of TV where she was on the show, and she used to bounce my little my daughter on her on
Jessie?
Her lap. She used to bounce. Jennifer.
Jennifer.
And she'd bounce Jennifer. She called her. Minnie called my daughter her little rat tail.
Okay.
But, you know, in country music, when you have hit records and you're doing these shows, country music is a small community of performers and stuff. So you end up knowing everybody. So like I did Hee Haw, and when you would go to do Hee Haw, you knew the cameraman because you just worked with that cameraman on the blah, blah, blah show, you know.
Okay.
So everybody, you knew the makeup lady. It was just like really going to your relative's house, you know, and which is what I really liked about country music. You could see the same people on every show, and
I got a question.
Sure.
You have Jesse and Jennifer, Chris and Tyler. Is there one more?
Yeah, there's Sarah.
Sarah.
Yeah, Sarah, okay. My daughter, my oldest daughter.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The reason I asked, you know, mention this, because maybe 20 years from now
absolutely.
2 years from now, or next week, they'll listen to this.
That would be great.
And get all their names in there.
Well, I'm sure she'd appreciate it.
Yeah, Sarah, Tyler, Chris, Jennifer, and Jesse, of course.
Absolutely.
Speaking about Jesse, I got to tell you, we have a big show coming up about 2 weeks from now, and that is the Defeat of Jesse James Days.
I wish I was there for that.
Well, you can make arrangements.
Soda's wildest weekend is almost here. The Defeat of Jesse James Days in Northfield is September 6th through the 9th with fun for the whole family. Check out the reenactment of the failed bank raid by the notorious James Younger Gang in 1876. The PRCA Professional Rodeo. Enjoy live music in the entertainment center. Bring the kids to the carnival. Visit the car show and so much more. Visit djjd.org for complete event listings. The Defeat of Jesse James Days, September 6th through the 9th, in Northfield.
Hi, welcome to this Subway ad for the Buffalo Rotisserie Style Chicken Signature Wrap. How would you like it?
I'll take a rallying cry, please.
Coming right up.
Crusaders of flavor! Ahead lies the bold and spicy Buffalo Rotisserie-style chicken signature wrap. There may come a day when you wish for bland flavor, but it is not this day! This day, we feast! Go forth to Subway and make it what you want! Limited time at participating shops.
Southern Minnesota's wildest...
I stand in line until
something
you think
stupid.
You have the time to spend an evening with me.
Who is it singing?
It's Frank Sinatra and his daughter, Nancy Sinatra.
If we go someplace,
no, this is not your genre.
No, but I played on the genre with a lot of these kind of acts, too.
It's
a recording session player.
Well, when I was looking at the top 10 hits of the year 1968, this is 67.
Yeah, produced by Jimmy Bowen and Glenn Campbell on guitar. I remember a little bit about this recording because I was Jimmy Bowen's guitar player too, and I played with what's his name that had Jimmy Rogers. Remember him?
Oh yeah,
I played on a couple.
Falling in Love.
I played on his album, and really interesting story about Jimmy Rogers. When he came to do the session, it was after his accident where these guys dressed as policemen had pulled him over to the side of the freeway and beat his head in with a pipe, and he almost died. And he lost all the ability to kind of sing, and he had to kind of go through all sorts of tests and exercises to get his voice back. And he would forget things, you know, in the middle of a sentence. So the producer got all of the musicians together before the session and said, listen, there's going to be, when Jimmy's doing the vocal with you guys, if he fades off and drops out, somebody act like, one of you guys act like you made a mistake and cover for him. So we did, and we did, well, Jimmy would fall in the middle of a sentence, he'd fade away. The drummer would drop his sticks, you know, and say, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't, you know, and cover for him. It was really touching. It's a really touching scene.
What happened? Why did they pull him over?
Tend to think that it was a gangland kind of deal, you know, and these
Jimmy Rogers?
Jimmy Rogers,
and
yeah.
Gangs?
Yeah, yeah. I hate to say mafia, it sounds so cliche, but yeah, he was nearly killed. And he made a comeback, though. And when he sang, he had a beautiful, beautiful voice. And, but there were times in the session when we had to cover for him because he had that memory problem. And even when he was reading, sometimes he'd be singing and da 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 da, and then you wouldn't hear his voice, you know, and you knew that he was going through a little bit of a problem.
Kind of like Glenn Campbell towards the end.
Well, Glenn Campbell, yeah,
and that, we all know that story.
Yeah,
What a great and sad story, and what a brave man to have done what he did.
That was my first gig in Hollywood. I played on the Glenn Campbell Good Time Hour.
Oh.
It was my first paid corporate gig in Hollywood. And
you still have the check in front?
No, I don't, but I got
needed the money.
I got $250 a week, and my job was to sing to the studio audience between set changes, you know. And I would answer questions, you know, keep them occupied while they're set. And so I didn't know much about Glenn Campbell, and so one day the producer got me backstage and said, listen, John, you're doing a great job, you know, but I just have to tell you, you need to learn who Glenn Campbell is. And I said, well, what do you mean? The producer said, he's not from Moline, Illinois. So quit telling people he's from Moline, Illinois. He's from he's Delight, Arkansas. And he says, so, you know, it's his show. You should know a little bit about him. So,
and he spent a little time with the Beach Boys.
Oh, yeah, and a lot of other people. I mean, he played on tons of hit records. I wanted to be Glenn Campbell as far as a guitar player went. He was an idol of mine.
And I don't think of him as a guitar player. I think of him as
a singer.
But
yeah. He was the number one studio guitar player from probably 1963 to probably to 70 when he had his own hits.
All right. It's 14 minutes before 11 o'clock on the Wayne Eddy Affair on KYMN from Northfield, Minnesota, 95.1 FM, streaming at kymnradio.net. John Beeland is my guest this morning, and he'll be performing this evening at the Northfield Arts Guild. Last I heard, there's about a dozen tickets left. You can call the Arts Guild, and they'll be more than happy to electronically gets you a ticket. And you'll hear the stories and more that you've heard on the radio here today. And, of course, you'll be able to enjoy his guitar playing and his singing. I was doing the top 10 tunes, and let's see what connection.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Fire away.
Okay, number one, number 10, mm-hmm. the Beatles. We already talked about that connection mm-hmm. because you, okay.
Right.
And then number 9 was the Turtles, Happy Together.
Yeah, Howard. Howard from the Turtles is a friend of mine. He's a lead singer, and Howard Kalin. And he's still out there doing it. He does these Happy Together tours.
Okay.
And where he brings like Gary Puckett out and people like that.
How many people have that as our song?
Oh, man, are you kidding?
My wife and I. We have to tell you that.
Why didn't I write that song?
Yeah. I'm going to give you a song that would remind me. I'll give you a song.
Okay.
We talked about The Doors and Light My mm-hmm, Fire.
Right.
Okay, one of my favorite songs, but it was really short. And I remember being a stand-up disc jockey doing this one. And gonna da 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 da
What was it?
The Box Tops.
The Box Top, the letter, yeah.
The letter, yeah.
I don't know those guys, but they were from the South, and I loved the letter. It was a great record.
I did, too.
Yeah,
it was and it's 2 minutes long.
Well, yeah, that's right. It's a real short song, you know. What a great voice that guy was. He passed away last year. I forget his name, but, man, they were
number 7 in all of 1967. Number 6. The Young Rascals Groovin' on a Sunday afternoon.
I was a huge fan of them when they first came out because they did their repertoire on their first album. It was the same kind of songs that we were playing on the south side of Chicago. The bands were playing kind of R&B, white R&B kind of songs, you know, Midnight Hour. And so I got that first album, and I learned how to play the Hammond B3 organ from listening to that album. Felix Cavalieri was a great organ player, and I remember that was one of my sources of reference was that first Rascals album. Yeah,
great.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then, of course, we just heard Frank Sinatra and his mm-hmm. daughter Nancy, Something
right.
Stupid. And then we didn't talk about it very much, but number 4 in 1967, what were they throwing off the bridge?
Oh, the Tallahatchie Bridge.
Yeah.
And
to Billy Joe.
They never did say what that was.
She was supposed to do it after 25 years.
Was it a baby?
Well, that's what everybody thinks. Yeah. That's what I think.
Yeah.
But,
I don't know.
And then the 25 years came and she still didn't reveal it.
Do you know the weird thing about Bobby Gentry is that she has virtually vanished from the internet or any, but you cannot find anything about her now or what she's doing today, you know, and she just kind of just disappeared. She was married to Bill Hara up in Harris and Tahoe, who had but then after they divorced, she just vanished. And if you look her name up, like today, like where is Bobby Gentry today? There's this kind of like cult that's looking for her, to trying to figure out what she's doing, where she's living, and there's nothing on her, you know.
So Bobby Gentry,
very mysterious.
Do 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 do.
Windy.
Yes.
Windy. So, and then there was a group, the association. They started at the club that I started in Los Angeles, the Troubadour, and they were great, the great harmony group, and they were kind of like offshoots of the folk era. They were the guys in the band were all former folk singers. And they were great. They were a great group. These series, Never My Love, Cherish is the Word. They had a lot of hits.
And that was number 3 uh-huh. in all of 1967 on the pop Billboard. Mm-hmm. The number 2 song we talked about, The Monkees, Daydream
Liberty. Right. Uh-huh.
But the number 1 song really surprises me.
The number 1 song in 1967.
If you don't, I'll give you a hint.
Okay.
Tubby. Comic book.
Yeah.
Tubby was the boy.
Yeah.
Who was the girl? The comic book.
Oh, God.
Lulu.
Oh, Lulu. To Start With Love.
Yeah.
Really? That was the number one record.
Yeah, isn't that weird?
Yeah, I would have never have guessed
that's
that.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
I didn't. I
was surprised. Have you seen Lulu lately? She's beautiful. I mean, she was I chase around the table.
Okay. Well, at that, we'll take a break, and we'll be back with our guest this morning, John Beeland, on the Wayne Eddy Affair on your radio station, the one, 95.1 FM, KYMN.
Live the legend and throw axes with your friends at the all-new Battle Axe Pub. Visit Magic, the live unicorn, hug a kangaroo, pet an African porcupine, or hand-feed a grape to a ring-tailed lemur. Soar over the crowd at the Wizards Flight School Zipline. Have a blast at the new Bow Blast competition. The Minnesota Renaissance Festival. Family fun for one and all. Weekends and Labor Day through September 30th. Discount tickets at Super America, Cub, Menards, Dunn Brothers, and online at renaissancefest.com.
It takes special skills to be a Daikin Comfort Pro. Let's listen in as he senses an old inefficient system's imminent demise.
So costly. Tormented by an ongoing battle over the thermostat. Its days are numbered.
You got all that by waving your hand in the air in our living room?
Get to know your local Daikin Comfort Pro.
This is Andy Straits with Straits 72 Degrees, your local third-generation business. Call me at 645-4040 or straitsheating.com.
Oh, this is what? Track one. This is okay. I wrote
this.
Excuse me. That's all right. I wrote this. This is good. This is the title song off the album. So that's all right.
Okay.
I've seen the world from a silver eagle, rented cars and custom vans. I've seen the good and the bad in people through the eyes of a five-piece band. I've hit the big time, I've hit the bottom, lost some friends along the way. Now and then I think about them, they were the good old days. I want to go back when the music left me spellbound, when rock and roll wore rhinestone clothes, when the steel cried in the 12-string jangle, back to the sweethearts of the rodeo. I've been to Nashville, L.A., New York. I've played in England's London town. I shared the stage with boyhood heroes. I watched a few get knocked down. Now and then I get to thinking about the times and places we left behind, before our circle was unbroken, before the changing times. I want to go back when the music left me spellbound, when rock and roll wore rhinestone clothes, when the steel cried in the 12-string jangle, back to the sweethearts of the rodeo.
On KYMN Radio, from his album,
Best Seat in the House.
That's it.
Just like the book.
You know, I'm confused. I'm listening to that, and it brings back memories.
Yeah, sure.
But I didn't connect it to a rodeo, or did I play it long enough?
Well, no. Sweethearts of the Rodeo refers to an album that the Byrds recorded called The Sweethearts of the Rodeo, and that also came out in 67. And that was considered the first country rock album, the first rock band that did country music, too. And it was a landmark album.
It was a group, too, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the Byrds. And they recorded. There was a country group called Sweethearts of the Rodeo.
Thank you.
It was Vince Gill's wife.
Oh.
And her sister. They had a duet called that. But Sweethearts of the Rodeo represents that era when all of a sudden all the rock and rollers were playing acoustic guitars now, and starting groups like the Eagles and country rock, and that was a great period for me, 1967. So that's why I said it might be nice to go back to the Sweethearts of the Rodeo when it was all starting, and I mentioned clubs in there that were important.
Well, this will all be part of your program tonight, your show.
Absolutely, we'll be talking about all of that.
Mm-hmm. And so you'll do, what time does that start?
7 o'clock, I think. I believe it's 7 o'clock.
Okay, yeah. 7 o'clock at the Northfield Arts Guild Theater, which is just up the block from the Quarterback Club.
And we'll have CDs and...
T-shirts?
No T-shirts, okay. But we'll have the book. And I'll be happy to sign copies of the book for you or CD. And, it should be a fun night. I think people will find something in there that they enjoy.
One of the things I do when I interview people is that I think everybody likes to name drop,
right.
But I encourage it.
Oh, yeah,
because
sure.
It's a show that I'm doing here, and I like to hear about the fun or the disappointment people have had in worlds that we don't know other than to listen or see.
Well, absolutely. You know,
go ahead.
I was just going to say it's our life. You know, I mean, I've been doing this since I was, like I said, since I was 18. And when I say doing it, I mean in Hollywood recording, and it's been my world for all of my life. So you know, I mean, when I name drop, most of these people, they're all friends of mine,
yeah.
And people I've had not only a professional relationship with, but a personal one, and that's very special to me when I look back on it. I mean, it's nice to talk about. Again, they were big stars, but I remember most of them as people.
Well, I think that's what will be fun and interesting tonight.
Yeah.
And I know you mentioned we both have hit the 50-year mark,
yeah.
And you go, holy cow, people back then, anybody that had 50 years
are
of business
you kidding?
Are old and
yeah, ancient.
Yeah.
Oh, get out of here. Yeah.
Tell me the funniest, weirdest, meanest, craziest green room.
Green Room. The Troubadour, for being the famous club that it was, had a terrible dream. Green Room. I think it was green from mold. You know, it was like the size of a closet. And in that little green room, that moldy little green room in that famous club, is where I first met an unknown guy named Chris Christopherson. And he had just blown into town. And he was huddled in that green room trying to get his guitar out of the case. He had no beard, clean shaven, hair slicked back, suede pants that were falling apart on him, a black T-shirt, and boots that were all beat up. And his guitar had the engraved in the guitar were his friends' autographs, you know, that he knew. And that's where and he sat me down in that little room. And asked me to play guitar for him that night at the Troubadour on an open mic night. Nobody knew who he was. He was staying at a friend's house on the sofa. And he said, I remember him saying, okay, well, here's the songs I'm going to do. I wrote these things. And he started playing me and Bobby McGee for the good times, help me make it through the night. Tunes that would go on to not only become hit records.
He was already established at this time?
No, he wasn't established at all.
Okay.
And these songs would later go on to not only become hit records, but they would literally change the course of country music, you know. And there we were, just him and I, in that little green room that you talked about in a darkened hallway. And so that was probably the green room I remember the most, you know.
Me and Bobby McGee is a Janis Joplin
absolutely.
Big hit. Yeah.
Yeah, he wrote that for her, and Roger Miller recorded the first version.
Chug-a-lug, chug-a-lug, baby, chug-a-lug. Don't you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, that song was banned in some cities like Boston.
Really?
Yeah, because it encouraged drinking.
Oh.
Just like I Saw Mama Kissing Santa Claus,
yeah.
That was banned on a
now,
Boston radio station.
How could that be banned?
Well, because Santa Claus is kissing mother.
Wow.
And she's married and all that.
Somebody's got a real problem if they're banning Santa Claus.
Yeah, well, that was years and years ago. And just an interesting fact, though.
What a world we live in.
Yeah. I remember listening to Roger Miller on my first rate from an Eau Claire radio station.
Right.
On my way to Toma, Wisconsin, my first radio job. Yeah. And baby, don't you know, jug-a-lug. What's that other one?
Trailer for sale, rent room,
50 cents. King of the road.
And he also had, you can't roller skate in a buffalo herd.
That's true.
And
wow.
You would really do called Kansas City Star about a disc jockey in Omaha that he's doing so great in Omaha, he never wants to leave it because he gets all the perks, free discounts at the car dealership. And so New York keeps trying to get him to come to New York to hit the big time. And he says, I don't need the big time. He says, I got everything I need down here in Omaha. And he's on the air. He's a radio disc jockey.
Yeah.
And it's called Kansas City Star. That's what I are. You little lady, you ought to see my car.
Yeah, I vaguely remember that. I'll have to listen to that.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we're out of time.
Boy, that went quick.
You know, I have to tell you something. What you just said is a quote that I get from the vast majority of my guests.
Oh, great.
What are we going to talk about for 2 hours is what they say.
Yeah.
And at the end, they say, wow, that went quick.
You get two guys like us have been around forever.
Yeah, that's true.
Doesn't
well,
stop.
Some of my guests say when they're in their 20s, I kind of, oh, boy, this is mm-hmm. going to be hard. But
yeah.
There's always something to talk about.
Well, I've had a great time being here, and I'm so honored that you had me come down for 2 hours, you know. And it was a really joyful. joy to meet you, and it's always great to meet somebody who's been in the business, you know, a long time like I have. You know, there's so much in common that you could talk all day.
Amen.
Yeah.
If you pass this way again, let me know.
I will. I intend to.
Okay. Yep. Tonight, 7 o'clock at the Northfield Arts Guild. There are a couple or some few tickets left. Contact the Northfield Arts Guild and pick up some tickets. You'll enjoy his music, his guitar playing, and his stories especially. In addition to that, what was I going to say? Oh, your book. We got to remember your book. And
Best Seat in the House.
Best Seat in the House. You'll mm-hmm. have that there. And if people want an autograph, you'll be happy to do that. And we'll say goodbye, but we also want to mention one more time, Jesse and Jennifer, Chris and Tyler and Sarah.
That's great.
And throw in your brothers Bob and Tom.
Great.
From, actually, the name is Hometown, Illinois.
That's right.
Although your children have probably been born all over.
Oh, yeah, Nashville and California. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you, Wayne. It's been an honor.
My pleasure. This is the one, KYMN 1080 Northfield, Minnesota, on your AM dial. It is 11 o'clock.
95.1. The one.